Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Some crushes are brief. The guy at the gym, the girl on Twitter, your barista. But others are epic and take on a life of their own. Marina Shifrin writes about that kind of intense crush in her essay, A Life Plan for Two, Followed by One. It's read by Olivia Munn, who stars in The Predator, in theaters now.
Kevin was everything an overweight 10-year-old girl could ever hope for in a man. His hair was the color of Cheetos, and he was an incredible speller. It was decided. I was in love. You live six houses down from me, he said, making my heart turn inside out. My family had just moved to Highland Park, Illinois, from Skokie, Illinois, and I didn't know anyone. Here was this magnificent boy who actually had taken the time to calculate how many houses stood between us. I started to wonder if the glow from my wedding dress would make him look washed out. Soon after, I began devising a plan in which Kevin and I would end up together forever, as all my notebooks stated. Months of morning strolls to the bus yielded a confession from Kevin. He had a crush on Caitlin, who was thin, blonde, and cheery. My opposite. I didn't mind. I figured it would be healthy for us to see other people before we spent the rest of our lives together. When he asked me whom I liked, I panicked. I wasn't ready to reveal my plan. So I made a promise. I'd tell him everyone I'd ever liked on my 16th birthday. It worked. He went back to lusting for Caitlin, and I went back to picking out names for our children. On my 16th birthday, Kevin, who by then had moved on crush-wise to Haley, was waiting in my driveway. Admitting to your best friend that you have liked him for the entirety of your friendship is about as awkward as getting a bikini wax from your dentist. I could have lied, but Kevin had developed this annoying habit of reading my thoughts. Finally, I worked up the courage to tell him the truth. I'd had a crush on him for a few years, but was totally over it. Totally. He took the news as any scrawny, pale high school boy would, by triumphantly leaning back in his chair like a champion. I began to worry about the plan and our future together, not knowing that a few months later, we would encounter our largest obstacle yet. Surprisingly, our relationship hadn't changed much after my confession. About 4 years earlier, we had started a tradition where we would shoot hoops at one of our houses until it was time for dinner. Very 1970s of us, even though it was really the late 90s. And one night, a few months after I had partly professed my love, we decided to just sit and talk, lamenting how high school was half over and neither of us had received our first kiss. 10 minutes later, I was wiping slobber from my double chin, shocked at how easy that was. The plan was progressing much faster than I had imagined. A couple of months after our first kiss, Kevin asked me to come over because he had something to tell me. I grabbed my basketball and greased my lips with Lip Smacker's Dr. Pepper flavor. As I passed the fourth house, my stomach sank. I realized Kevin was going to ask me out, and I was going to have to say no. It was too early. I knew we had to wait until after college so both of us could get good at sex. That's what college is for, right? When I arrived, he was already shooting hoops. We threw the ball around until I was ready to explain why we had to wait before we became girlfriend-boyfriend. So, I have a girlfriend, Kevin said, interrupting my thoughts. I was stunned. That's so great, I yelled over my shoulder. My mom said I need to be home to help with dinner and clean my room. Okay, bye. Their relationship went strong for the first year, and even stronger for the second. I began to lose faith in the plan. Then, Kevin's first girlfriend cheated on him during our senior year spring break. As soon as I heard the news, I skipped up his driveway with a basketball under my arm. It wasn't until I saw how devastated he was that I decided to focus my energy on putting him back together. Before I could even get excited about the possibility of taking her place, college entered the picture, and with it came our largest speed bump. I was moving to Missouri, and Kevin was staying in Illinois. He came over the morning I was leaving for Missouri. I had promised he would be the last person I said goodbye to before I left. He cried, and I made fun of him. Then we sat in my driveway, dreading the fact that we wouldn't live six houses away from each other anymore. Thanks to the wonders of 21st century technology, we stayed close. But it wasn't until our junior year that the plan started up again. I was going through my latest breakup when Kevin suggested I come visit him. Approximately 5 seconds after he suggested it, I hopped into my car and made the 7-hour trek to Chicago. I remember scanning the disgusting walls of his frat house as I swirled the contents of my red Solo cup. Somewhere between the last drink and his morning alarm, Kevin and I moved into the final phases of my plan. We slept together. For some reason, though, it ended up feeling more like a goodbye than a hello. The next morning, we gave each other a confused embrace before I walked to my car with what felt like one of the worst hangovers of my life. The cold Chicago air ripped tears from my eyes as I slammed my car door and checked my phone. A text from Kevin. When do you want to talk about this? I wasn't hungover. I was heartbroken. I sat in my car and sobbed. Later that week, Kevin told me he valued our friendship too much to take the risk of dating. I told him I totally agreed. Totally. Yet I still wasn't quite ready to abandon the plan. If I've learned anything during the approximately 27 times I've watched When Harry Met Sally, it's that you need to ignore your best friend for a month, and in that time, he will realize he's in love with you and will come charging back into your life at the first available opportunity. So, I ignored Kevin's texts and calls, patiently waiting for him to realize we really were supposed to be together. When I was back home for New Year's, I made sure every status advertised my whereabouts for the night. How else was he going to burst in at midnight to tell me he couldn't live without me? Spoiler alert, he didn't. Subsequently, I decided to move to New York, where 20-somethings who no longer believe in love go to pursue more attainable goals, like being a stand-up comic. One day, I awoke to an email from my parents. The basketball hoop in my front yard had been knocked over during a storm, and they decided to remove it completely. I took this as a sign to officially abandon the plan. This time, I cut Kevin out of my life completely and began to focus on more important things, like my blossoming waitressing career. Years later, I was surprised to find myself sitting in a booth across from Kevin in Highland Park. He held my hands as I cried over all the time we'd lost, while I was too busy ignoring his apologies and refusing his friendship. I asked if he could forgive me for trying to push him out of my life, and he responded with, "I'm just glad there isn't a redheaded 2-year-old sitting next to you." We were going to be okay. With that, I returned to the city where homeless dreamers rub elbows with the dreamers with homes, hopeful that our reunion would repair what had been lost. Slowly, we began talking again and keeping track of each other's lives. Our conversations were different now that I had given up the self-consciousness that plagues girls who have fallen in love. A couple of months ago, I was crashing at my parents' house before moving out of the country. Kevin came over for a quick goodbye before heading to work. He got out of his car and gave me a hug. "Why do you have to move so far away from me?" he asked as our chins wrapped around each other's shoulders. My heart, once again, turned inside out. I am no longer in love with Kevin, but I love him. 2 letters? Big difference. I love him when he has girlfriends and I have boyfriends. I love him when he makes me laugh and when he makes me cry. I love him when he says goodbye and when he says hello. I love him when he knows my thoughts and even when he doesn't. I know he will always be there, no matter how hard I try to get rid of him. The plan had totally worked. Totally.
That's Olivia Munn reading Marina Shifrin's piece, A Life Plan for Two, followed by One. We'll catch up with Marina and Kevin after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing?
It's actually a really complicated question.
To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
When we read this story, we had a lot of questions for Marina. But we also wondered, what did everything look like from Kevin's perspective? So we invited both of them to join us. And Kevin brought us back to the first day they met with an entry from the diary he kept back in fourth grade.
May 6th, 1998. A new girl joined named Marina. She's at my bus stop and is in Mrs. Wyden's class. She's kind-o-nice.
Kevin says that 20 years later, his friendship with Marina is still going strong. And he told us what it was like to read the essay she'd written about their relationship.
The first time I read it, it was kind of emotional because I didn't know exactly how she was going to end it. I just kind of figured there was a few different varieties to go. And I don't know, I got a little emotional. I thought it was really cute the way that she spun our tale. And, you know, I got asked a lot at the time about it, and I gave the same reaction. I was like, it's just incredible writing, you know, regardless of my role in it. My first reaction every time I read it was just how good of a story it was.
For Marina, publishing this piece was a bit terrifying. She says it felt like someone had put her diary entry on every locker in the high school. But the reaction she got from readers wasn't exactly what she'd expected.
After the story was published, I was surprised with how many people were rooting for us to get together. And it was so weird because for so many years, I was the only person rooting for us. And then this article came out and all of these people are emailing me. And I think Kevin got a little bit of it, just being like, what are you doing? Ask her out. And we were so far past that time.
A little bit of it. I still get it. and my first reaction when people said that was like, I'm like, well, didn't you read the story? You know, the way I read it, and of course I'm biased, if you read it that way, you say, oh, okay, they're just really, really close friends, and they had different views of each other in this way, and this is how it turned out, and it's this actually kind of nice, sweet ending. And just obviously that wasn't good enough for a lot of people, certainly in my life. I think Marina can attest that my mom was one of those people who read it and was kind of wondering, well, what could have been?
I mean, I love Kevin to death, but, like, we like all the opposite things. And he, like, drives me crazy, but not in a cute and fun way. Like, I want to strangle him in his sleep sometimes, so.
Yeah, and nobody, like, we got on each other's nerves, but it wasn't like, oh, that's so cute. They kind of rile each other up.
Yeah, Kevin doesn't like chocolate, so that's pretty, it's the only thing I need to say.
Marina says that she has one piece of advice for people who are in the friend zone.
I want anyone who's in the friend zone to break out of it by telling their crush that they have a crush and they'd like to date. Because I think a lot of people in the friend zone just accept that that's where they live and they never go up to the person and say, I like you. I think we would make a great couple. Do you want to date me? Which is kind of psychotic to say, but very effective in finding out and not wasting a lot of years and tears over a relationship that's not meant to be.
And letting go of her crush helped Marina find the person she says she is meant to be with, someone she met through Kevin when she was doing stand-up at a Chicago bar.
So I just bombed, and I remember Kevin was there with a fraternity brother named Sam, and I knew of Sam. He had always been in Kevin's life, and they'd been roommates at one point. And I remember being mad at Kevin for bringing a really cute guy to my horrible show. And then, yeah, a few weeks after that, Kevin brought Sam to another show, and then eventually Sam started coming on his own, and then Sam and I went on a few dates, and then we got married last week. I skipped a lot, but the timing is there.
Kevin gave a speech at Marina's wedding. He read it for us, and here's a bit from the end.
I've known Marina for 20 years. I've never seen her happier. I've known Sam for 12 years. I've never seen him happier. When two people who you love individually fall in love with each other, well, that's the dream, right? I cannot take all the credit, but I'm happy to take a little for helping these two goofballs find each other. To Sam and Marina, or Marina and Sam.
Yay! That was so great. I almost cried. That was even better the second time.
As for how this essay fits into Marina's relationship with Sam, well, the piece is framed and hanging in a closet in their home.
I don't want people to walk in and see me just framing, like, every magazine clipping and all that kind of stuff. But I do have, like, a Marina closet. And my dad went in there. It's where my recycling is. Very glamorous. To recycle something. And he saw the article. And my dad was like, Sam is a strong man. I would not allow my wife to hang up a story about another man and under my roof. Because my dad's like this conservative Russian man. And I thought it was very funny. But I always appreciate when people see that it's a story about teen love, and it's light and awkward and funny and sweet. And I really appreciate people who can see it for what it is.
That's Marina Shifrin and Kevin Fishbane. Kevin is a sports writer for The Athletic Chicago, and he recently got engaged. Marina is a comedy writer who's written for Comedy Central and NBC. She just published a book of comedic essays, 30 Before 30, How I Made a Mess of My 20s, and You Can Too. It's about her attempt to accomplish 30 life goals before turning 30. We've got more after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
Pretty rarely do modern love essays cover so much time in 1,500 words to be able to start off in childhood and wind up in adulthood and cover everything in between is pretty hard to do without just summarizing everything. But Marina's story depends on that arc of history from childhood to adulthood. And what I love about this piece is how it's sort of a lesson on the enduring nature of love and friendship that veers into romantic love, which is, if it doesn't work, is normally fatal for the friendship, but then pulls back out of that again. And it's sort of a sweet meditation on who we keep in our lives over time, no matter what, and what, you know, what kind of love that is.
And here's Olivia Munn.
The thing that I loved about this story was that everybody has hopes and dreams, and, you know, we put a lot of energy into hoping things work out a certain way. And as we all know in life, things don't always work out the way that we always hope or plan for. But the one thing you can control is who you are and how you see life. And she had a really great positivity at the end, and she's maintained this friendship, and she's allowed it to grow and change as she's grown and changed. And I think that's a great lesson for anyone to learn in life.
Thanks again to Olivia for reading this week's essay. Olivia stars in The Predator, and it's in theaters now. Next week, Rita Wilson.
When my best friend since childhood wound up back on the oncology unit for her third relapse, I decided it was time to start online dating. I knew from Nance's prior hospitalizations that talking about lymphoma and PET scans was not her idea of fun. A far better entertainment would be for me to get on Match.com so we could hang out together on her hospital bed scrolling through potential dates.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Parati. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.